The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, we're sounding like two old men with nothing better to talk about than the weather these days. But Sunday was another brutal day weather-wise in Japan for the 8J1 game scheduled. We just haven't had much luck here lately, have we?
No, we haven't. It's kind of taken away from a few of the games. And it does seem to be in and around the Tokyo region, wind and rain everywhere, making conditions, yeah, really difficult. So hopefully the summer appears at some point because, yeah, the last couple of weeks have been pretty much a nightmare for the teams to have to deal with.
Indeed. So no kickoffs were postponed, at least as far as I'm concerned over the weekend. But yeah, Sunday especially was pretty rough. I should also mention Sam and say a big thank you. I'm sure our patrons will echo this. The speed with which you got out your midweek match day 5 written review. Frankly, to most of it beggars belief how you can firstly watch 9 games at once and then within about 2.5 hours get detailed match reports about all of them done. Fairly a superhuman effort, but well done, and I'm sure the patrons are looking forward to more of it as the season continues.
Well, thank you very much. It was, yeah, a real rushed effort trying to get notes down over all the games playing at the same time. I'm not really sure how I managed it, but hopefully people enjoyed it.
I'm sure they did. Yes, indeed. All right. Well, yeah, one of the notable results from midweek was our leaders, Kawasaki, dropping their first points of the season. And it was away at Kobe on Wednesday when Ryuho Kikuchi's header in the 10th minute of second half stoppage time earned Vissel a 1-1 draw against the defending champions at the Noriviru Stadium. So that meant that, Kawasaki actually had to bounce back from something resembling a setback for the first time this season. So how did they get on when they visited Urawa on Sunday? Well, to help us run through events at the Saitama Stadium, it's a big welcome back to the podcast to our Kawasaki correspondent, Neil Debnam. Neil, welcome back to the pod, and how are you?
Great, thanks. Thanks for inviting me back again, and I knew you were going to wait till we had a dodgy result before you wanted me to say anything to the people.
Well, yeah, I got in just before kickoff on Sunday. I didn't want to have that result influence whether you were going to come on or not. But as I said in the intro there, we were all curious to see how Frontale would bounce back from dropping points for the first time all season. And, it took you most of the first half to get properly on top of Reds. Once you did, obviously the floodgates opened. And if you haven't heard already, listeners, Frontale ran out 5-0 winners away at Urawa. But we can obviously celebrate all the terrific goals your team scored shortly, Neil. But firstly, needing to bounce back, a couple of big names rested in the form of Kaoru Mitoma and Akihiro Iyanaga. And the first half hour, at least, from what I saw, looked fairly even. Reds, put on a little bit of a show for their fans, which is something that the home support has been longing for up there.
Yeah, it seemed pretty square, to be honest. But I think it was, aside from like the two good sort of volleyed chances, one for us from Yamane and Sugimoto had one as well. But I mean, apart from that, it felt like it was pretty scrappy affair. So I think it was even, but even in that both teams were rubbish rather than both teams were doing particularly well. But we definitely needed something. We needed a bounce back, and unfortunately the bounce in the first half wasn't really a bounce. It was more of like a, what's the opposite of a bounce, like an absorption or something, I don't know. The first half was disappointing, but I understand that we were gonna sort of jiggle the forward line a little bit. I understand why, and it was pretty exciting, I think, for some of us Frontale fans, that we could have Kobayashi and Damião playing together, because it's never really been done much before. And I'm sorry, I have my theories about why that might be. But it took a while to get going. But I think we'd all be quite happy with a dodgy first half, when considering what happened in the second half.
Yeah, can't argue with that. So, Sam, yeah, a couple of our Urawa supporting friends were quite positive as the first half progressed. Ryan Steele, who often joins us as our Reds correspondent, judging from his Twitter feed, at least until the Reds finally went behind, was quite satisfied with how things had gone. And in our Patreon-only line group, Ralph, who many of you know on Twitter as at Akakichino11, was also quite happy with how things were going for Reds, again, until they did fall behind slightly just before half-time. So how did you see the first half as it progressed?
Yeah, I thought it was a little bit scrappy, but I'd have said Red shaded it until the Kawasaki goal. They haven't played well, as we've said, for a few games now, but at least in this first half, they were trying to do their passing out from the back. Occasionally it was working quite well, and some of their build-up play was very nice. Neil mentioned this Sugimoto volley, but the build-up to that was really good. They were positive, getting on the ball a lot more. Kanako had come into midfield. I think he had a little bit more in possession. And then Sugimoto, it was a decent effort from him, probably the best thing he's done since the goal disallowed on the opening day. But yeah, they looked a little bit more positive. It looked more like what Rodriguez wanted from his team. They weren't giving the ball away quite as much as they were, especially against that Yokohama a couple of weeks ago. So I thought there were positives there. It might speak more to how poorly Reds have played in every other game, but I think this was the best they'd played since that opening game against Tokyo.
And then, with 3 minutes left until half-time, and obviously Reds would have been very pleased to go in at 0-0, they lost possession from their own throw, and Frontale swept forward. Yu Kobayashi heading down and past Shusaku Nishikawa from a lovely Miki Yamane cross. And, that obviously would have stung Reds going into the sheds. And then what happened shortly after the restart, Neil? As I said earlier, the floodgates just opened in remarkable fashion, didn't they? Three goals in a full 3 minutes and 40 seconds of game action. It was... it was just ruthless, and something that I guess you'd, maybe not become accustomed to, but yeah, you would have relished your team turning on displays like that on a fairly regular basis last season. And it's, a good reminder, and it's a warning sign for the rest of the league what your side is capable of.
Yeah, last season they seemed to come in pairs, so if they're coming in threes this year, I'll be I'm very happy. But it is especially nice to get some goals because, like you said, recently we have been a bit off the boil, I think, and sort of from the sort of the midweek game against Kobe, I really felt that we were the masters of our own downfall because I think we had two shots on target in the whole game. So it's nice to see things sort of getting a bit more dialed in and on focus slightly more. Yeah. Was there anything else you asked? Sorry.
No, that's fine. So actually, before we run through these three goals, I probably shouldn't have moved on before I brought up one of Naoya Kanai's questions on Frontale, Neil. And I guess, you were of the opinion that the first half was a bit flat and a bit scrappy, whereas Sam was, thinking that Reds were slightly on top if either team was shading it. So I guess, coming off of Wednesday's game as well against Kobe. So now you asks, as I said in the second part of his Patreon message, any concerns from you? Obviously, there won't be huge concerns after a 5-0 win, but that Kawasaki is showing some of the same cracks in your armour as you did towards the back end of last season, namely being vulnerable to teams which deploy high pressing and ball possession. So, again, we saw it a little bit in the second half of the Super Cup. We didn't see it at all against Yokohama in round one. But, have there been signs that you've noticed where your team has, as now you said, been a little bit vulnerable?
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm quite blinkered when it comes to watching Frontale, and I feel like if we're not winning, I feel like it's our fault rather than it sounds kind of arrogant in a way. It's like I deny any qualities from I deny the other teams any qualities. It's just like, oh, this is our fault while we're not winning. So maybe I'm not particularly I don't particularly pay enough attention to what the other team are doing, but definitely there has been sort of some concerns in the last few games. I think the Kashiwa game at home was pretty dire, and it seemed like for most of this year we were having one dodgy half and one good half, and then we sort of moved on to having two dodgy halves and somehow still winning the game. And I think, I guess in this game we got the good half and the dodgy half, but yeah, I don't know if it's if other teams have found us out or whether we're just not quite up to speed yet. And I don't know, it's like that was sort of when you have to follow up something, maybe it's there's some kind of like a performance anxiety or something like that. And the sort of the highs of last season are perhaps sort of are very difficult to repeat, and maybe that's sort of playing on people's minds a little bit. I think Oniki said he wanted to score three goals in every game this year, which is, I mean, I certainly wouldn't be saying that because I'm a lover or a hater of the jinx, whichever way you look at it. But I think he's kind of put some extra pressure on us in that respect, that, you know, we want to prove that it wasn't a one-off and that we're going to do well again this year. And, yeah, maybe that's weighing on people's minds a little bit. But, yeah, I don't know. There's been a, sort of some kind of transition from last year and a few kind of transformations in sort of, to sort of waver wildly off topic here. But Leandro Damião has sort of been pretty transformed, I think, because last year I was always talking about how, oh, it doesn't matter that he doesn't score that many goals because of the contributions he makes. And then this year he's knocking them in all kinds of styles, and he looks like sort of the striker that perhaps we thought we were getting when we signed him. So yeah, I've gone down a dead end there, but yeah, I think I'm slightly concerned about the frailties, but I think we needed to bounce back from probably two dodgy games, and this was kind of the right way to do it. And hopefully, yeah, it's a great time to build up some momentum before a 2-week break. So.
Yeah. Well, there's a perfect segue there for me there, obviously, Sam, because Damião scored the second goal. But do you want to have a little dip at Naoya's question as well? Of course, remembering the fact that Mitoma and Ianaga were rested here, and then, of course, Oshima and Naborizato haven't featured yet.
Yeah, I don't think there are major concerns, especially not going forward. I mean, the games where you only scored one goal against Kashua and Kobe, really, there were chances there for those three goals that Oniki wants. So at least those are being created in this game. Fantastic, scored the five goals. I think what I would say against Kobe, when you took the lead and then just didn't really control it, you're a lot more open. I think that is where Oshima really, and I say this all the time, but that's where Oshima kind of comes into it. He can control the midfield. He can kind of settle everyone down, so you don't have that kind of player in that midfield. And when you're making the substitutes, like Sukugawa is the one that comes in, or Tachibanada, and they don't really have the experience of like controlling a game in the way that Oshima does. And then the other issues, I think, are strangely, is Jesse Hill and Taniguchi, who I don't think have been quite up to it as they were last season. They both give the ball away a little bit too often. They've both been caught out a few too many times. Like last season, they just weren't. And whether that is because they have to deal with Hatate as a left back when he's really an attacker, and they've got a different midfielder in front of him, so maybe they don't have the kind of understanding with Schmidt just yet. But yeah, they've been a little bit dodgy for me. And it kind of strangely, Kurumaya and Yamamura have been very solid when they've played in the back four. So yeah, I'm sure that those two are fantastic players. They will get that understanding, they'll improve as the season goes on. So yeah, I don't see too many problems with Kawasaki. I think they're going along quite well, and if anything, the result against Kobe just kind of spurted them into action again, because they'd sort of coasted, I thought, through the Tokushima and the Kashua game. So maybe it's good every now and then to get a reminder and just to switch on a bit, and they definitely did second half.
Yeah, most definitely. Of course, yeah, recently they had been doing their business in the first half and then easing off in the second. Well, yeah, this was very much in reverse. So I mentioned Kobayashi got the first 3 minutes before half-time. He then turned to Provider 4 minutes after the restart, chipping in for Leandro Damião, who did brilliantly to control on his chest and volley in on the swivel. Reds again lost possession from their throw before the third goal in the 51st minute with the Jao Schmidt sliding a delicious through ball for left back Reo Hatate, who finished past Nishikawa with the outside of his right foot. And then Kobayashi chested in from a yard out in the 53rd minute. As I said, exactly 3 minutes and 40 seconds between all three goals. And I think Ryan Steele tweeted that he stepped aside for the first 10 minutes of the second half. So when he returned to his screen, the scoreline had gone from 1-0 to 4-0, and he wondered what on earth had gone on. Well, Reds somewhat steadied the ship, if you could say that, before Yasuto Wakizaka blasted in a 25-yard laser beam in the 67th minute to round out the scoring. So, Neil, they don't come much more satisfying than 5-0 wins away at Urawa, do they? And as you say, a little bit of momentum built up as you go into a two-week international break. But, speaking of that, the other half of Naoya's question was about some of the players that have been called up for international duty and what you're hoping to see from Kaoru Mitoma, Ao Tanaka, Miki Yamane, Reo Hatate and Yasuto Wakizaka as Japan, the full national teams get set to face South Korea in a friendly, and the under-24s play Argentina's under-24s in a pair of friendlies. So first thing first, obviously you're hoping they're not going to get injured, but I bet you've you'll be excited to see them do their business in a samurai blue kit.
Yeah, definitely. I hope that they actually get a chance, though, because I think in previous national squads we've had never this many players, I don't think, in recent times, but or maybe ever. But we've sent our players there, and basically they've just had a little holiday and trained somewhere different for a couple of weeks, and then watched an international match from the bench. So I hope they get involved. It's kind of unfortunate that the two players who probably need a rest the most in our squad have both been called up, which is Yamane and Hatate, because they've both been ever present so far. So that's possibly unfortunate, but I would never deny them the opportunity to play for their country, because I guess I'm sure it means a lot more to them than it means to me, because I've kind of gone off international football recently, but and they're playing and I'm watching, so that might raise the stakes slightly. But I hope they get a chance. I'm always club before country person, and it seems kind of a small-minded thing of me to say, but they don't have to do too well and attract any more attention, especially Mitoma, although that's probably a done deal anyway that he's going to leave at some stage. But to be honest, I hope they play. I hope they can put their name on even more on the map and maybe draw a bit of attention to us as well, but not in the way that someone will try and buy them or take them on a 2-year free loan and then transfer for free at the end of it or something like that. Mm.
I should also mention that the full national team are playing a World Cup qualifier against Mongolia as well at Chiba's Fukuda Denshi Arena, which will be interesting and great to see that venue used for a national team game. Just rewards for the last season and a bit that Kawasaki have had. And, it's inevitable that some of their players were going to get called up, even though, as Neil says, some of them could already do with an early season rest. But, neutral fans who maybe don't catch full Frontale games on a week-to-week basis, one of these several that have been called up that's really worth keeping an eye on?
Well, I mean, all of them are, to be honest. Mitoma, I think, is going to be fantastic, either with Kubo the other side for the under-24s. I can't wait to watch that. But I think the one player I'd look for is Ao Tanaka. I think he's in my opinion, has been the best player in the league so far this season. I think he's been incredible in that midfield. He's kind of taken on because Morita's gone, Oshima's not there, Nakamura's not there. And for him, what is he, 22, to take on that burden? And, yeah, he just runs that midfield. I think he's fantastic. And there is an opening, I think, in that Japan midfield. I don't think it's the strongest. A few players have kind of moved on. So Tanaka, with a couple of good performances here, if given the chance, which I hope he is, I think he could be cementing his place in the Japan national team for a while. I think, yeah, terrific player. So, yeah, he's the one I'd look out for. And I think Yamane has also got a chance with Sakai kind of towards the end of his career. There is a berth there for a right back, and Yamane has got his chance here. Hopefully he can take that as well, because he's come on leaps and bounds since joining Frontale at the start of last season.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. All right, so we'll get you out the door with one more question, Neil. It might be the easiest question of the entire episode, or indeed that you've been asked in all the times you've appeared on JTalk, or you might throw us for a little bit of a loop. I'm not sure. Johnny Nicol was wondering, in your time supporting Kawasaki, who is the best player you've signed from a fellow J1 side?
Well, I was going to say Sugimoto, Kenyu Sugimoto from Cerezo. I think he probably signed when they'd been relegated to J2. So I guess it has to be Ienaga, I suppose, if I can't have Sugimoto.
Well, yes, a winning player of the season in a championship-winning season, I suppose, puts him very much on the short list, and, yeah, right at the top of it, I would have to say. I don't know, were there any others receiving votes apart from Sugimoto? I don't know, maybe somebody slipped my mind who you had signed from a J1 team previously that has also become an important player for you. There wasn't another one that sprung to my mind, but have I missed anybody?
I don't think so. I mean, I was struggling to think myself, and I should say I don't mean to be mean to Sugimoto, because I quite liked him when he was with us, but it just seemed like an open goal not to say something like that, especially seeing as he was playing at the weekend and didn't score. So, I mean, I guess it's early days, but Yamane is probably up there at the moment. I mean, he's like Sam said, he's had an amazing impact and improved since he came. But I mean, I think I can't really think of anyone else.
I mean, Yoshida Okubo, but
Okubo when he came back.
Yeah,
Tokyo, yeah, same thinking. I guess the first time. I know, but did he come to us from abroad? Didn't he? I can't remember.
I think yes, with Kobe, wasn't he?
Maybe his best period was when he came back to us after FC Tokyo. So, if we include Okubo, I guess he's got to be up there. But I feel like he somehow, it's an awful thing to say for someone who scored so many goals for us, that he slightly tarnished his reputation with his last season before he went to Tokyo with us, because I felt like he was a bit of a pain in the neck in that season. Sorry, Yoshito. I think even if you take him into account, I think it's Ienaga for me, just because, like, I mean, oh God, now I'm going to sound like I'm being rude to Omiya and just everyone's going to hate me. But he was there, a big player at Omiya, but it didn't seem like, I mean, I've no reason to say this and no proof, no evidence or whatsoever, but it felt, even when we signed him, it did feel a little bit like it was, this is a guy who's been abroad. He's doing all right, but I don't think we realized how much he would sort of transform. And I think it took a few months for him to get into the swing of things, but he's a total legend for us now. So, so yeah, I think I can't really go past Ienaga, to be honest.
Yeah, no disagreement from me, and I'm sure from you as well, Sam.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. He's been fantastic. And I agree with what Neil said. When you signed Ienaga, he was like a good player for Omiya, but I don't think anyone had him down as future J1 MVP. So, yeah, the transformation that he made at Kawasaki has been terrific, and he continues to go this season as well.
All right, then. Well, we do have a couple of more questions from patrons on Urawa, but, yeah, I think we'll leave you, Neil, to bask in the glory of this 5-0 win, and we'll let you go and let you get on with the rest of your Monday evening, and, yeah, we'll Sam and I will handle those Reds questions after we bid you adieu. So, yeah, great to check in, and sorry if you thought I was being a bit cheeky asking you on after you, yeah, you dropped points for the first time this season, but, yeah, your boys well and truly made up for that on Sunday. So, great to catch up with you again. Yeah, hope all the international players come back to you fit and having impressed in the Samurai Blue kit. And, yeah, we'll catch up again in the coming weeks, I'm sure.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks a lot for asking. And, yeah, I was only joking about the Corbett thing.
Okay.
yeah, it's always a pleasure. And, yeah, thanks.
All right, thanks again to Neil. So, yeah, Sam and I have a bit more Reds stuff to discuss. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back. So, yeah, before we move on, we did have a couple of questions from patrons on Urawa. The first one we'll cover, Sam, comes from Gabriel Anello. He's asking what's happened to Shinzo Koroki after 157 goals in J1. There's no space for him in the new project for Urawa, or is he just injured? What's the latest on the once prolific and, well, always consistent Reds striker?
Yeah, well, he got injured the last game of last season. He's got some sort of tendon issue in his right thigh and around there. So he's been out for all of pre-season. He briefly appeared against Yokohama a couple of weeks ago. He had a kind of 10-minute cameo, but really he's still not fit. So they're just kind of taking their time with him. I imagine for the Levan Cup tie this weekend, you'll probably see him there. And yeah, that'll go with Nishi's coming back as well and Deng's coming back. And really we need to see those three players back before we really know what this Red side is all about. I think there was another question from Graham Fretcher wondering how worried Reds should be. And I think you've just got to wait until all these pieces are back in. You imagine Nishi and Deng should fit into that back line and should improve it. And Koroki will definitely improve them going forward. So, yeah, get those three in, see where they are from then. But it is going to be a long waiting game with Reds while they try and get this system up to speed, get all their players in. And I think, yeah, don't panic, Reds supporters. Don't panic, Reds board. Let Rodriguez stay on for this season. As long as they don't get relegated, I think it's fine, and you will see the fruits of the labour come next season. But, yeah, they need these three players back. Yeah, they should be crucial to the way that Rodriguez is going to play this season.
All right, so thanks to Gab and thanks to Graham Fretcher. But before we move off for Graham Fretcher's series of questions on Reds, Sam, I mean, Scott McIntyre mentioned the perilous financial situation at Urawa, which I think caught a few listeners by surprise last week. So the last question that Graham Fretcher asks is, without money to overhaul the squad, does this project have any long-term chances, whether Rodriguez is the right manager or not?
Well, as long as you were sensible with the way you build your squad, we've seen at Zagantosa they've got no money and they've developed so many good young players and are playing a fantastic brand of football. So it's definitely doable. And Red still had the ability to bring in Kaneko from Shonan. They brought in players from J2 and Rodriguez will know that market pretty well from his time at Tokushima. So I think as long as the players that they do bring in are correct, I think a project can be, kind of made with those younger players, and I think that'll be the way that Rodriguez goes. So money isn't everything in the world, as we all know, so I think it is definitely doable. Obviously you'd like a lot of money and go out and get your foreign players and whatnot, but I don't think a lack of funds is definitely derailing this, and there's no chance of success because we've seen it at various different clubs.
Yeah, fair enough. And as you say, yeah, J2, I mean, they've just taken Yoshio Koizumi from FC Ryukyu, and he's looked, right at home already in J1. So, yeah, they can unearth a few more diamonds on the slightly cheaper side in the next couple of transfer windows. Then, maybe Rodriguez will be able to shape the squad a bit more in his image. So we'll be hearing plenty more from Graham Freche throughout this episode, and indeed from Gab as well later on. One of Graham Freche's clubs that he supports, at least that we can gather from his handle, is Nagoya Grampus, and they carried on as they have been doing in recent weeks, Sam. A 1-0 win yet again, a sixth straight win to begin the season. This one was away at Kashima, so two of the bigger name clubs in J1 facing off, and Grampus doing the business again, and yet again it was Sho Inagaki for the not the third straight game, because I don't think he scored the winner in midweek, did he, Sam? But he did in both the games we covered in last week's episode, so that's three of the last four games he scored the winner in 1-0 Grampus victories. And this was another absolute special from Inagaki, a superb first time strike from inside the D after Mateus's corner was only half headed out. Just before the hour, Inagaki struck again, and it contributed to frustration for Kashima, no doubt, as this game got quite chippy in the second half, didn't it, Sam? And it all ended up with the hosts' antlers ending the game with 10 men after Tomoya Inukai was sent off for a second yellow card with just under 10 minutes left.
Yeah, there was plenty of frustration for Kashima in this game. Koizumi could have been sent off as well, as it got really bitty towards the end. Nagoya are the perfect team to see out a 1-0 victory. They do the dark arts of football very well. They annoy the opposition just because they can't get close to them in normal play, and then they just rile them up, and yeah, they're perfect at it. Nagoya, you can copy and paste the performance from every game that they play. They don't concede many chances at all. What they do concede is like long-range shots. I think Matsumura had one, but Langerak is going to save 99 out of 100 of those sorts of shots, and they're taking their chances at the other end. I mean, Sho Inagaki, didn't know he had this in his locker, or even though he had a locker, but it was fantastic. The technique on this volley is so good. Kind of on the half volley, just keeps it down low in off the post. Terrific effort. And yeah, well, I mean, what more can you say about Nagoya? They've just conceded so few chances. It's so difficult for any team to get a foothold in the game. And once you go behind, I think the heads just drop because they're just going to sit in. They're going to frustrate you. And Kashima have a lot of options to attack with. And really and truly, Langerak, other than that one save, he wasn't tested at all. And yeah, just Nagoya keep on going on. The only issue I would have with Nagoya is they don't create too many chances. And two of the last three games, they've won thanks to wonder goals. And I don't know how long that can continue by just relying on Inagaki scoring a terrific goal. So they need something from their strikers. They're not really getting it at the moment, but they're getting the results, and that's all that matters. So, yeah, fair play to Nagoya, and just defensively, they're absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it? It's five straight 1-0 wins, isn't it? Am I making that up? No, hang on. They won 3-0 in midweek, wasn't it? Yeah, they upset the form book there by actually scoring more than one goal. But it's remarkable run to start the season. They've just conceded the one goal to Fukuoka back on the opening day, and since then it's seven scored and none conceded. It's unfortunate for any Grampus fans who are looking for us to wax lyrical about your team for 20 minutes like we just did with Neil and Kawasaki. They're just a completely different kettle of fish, aren't they, Sam? We can obviously sing their praises as much as possible for their terrific defensive displays, but ultimately that's not quite as sexy as Frontale, is it?
Yeah, they're not a team for the highlights package, because you won't see much going either way, but just to watch them live and just to watch the way that defence works, and the way that Inagaki and Yonemoto patrol in midfield, and the way that Sommer and Mateus do the hard work going backwards as well. It's just so well organised, and you get to, we're with the Jelly International YouTube page now, we're getting player interviews, so we get Langerak after every game, because it obviously speaks English, and he's just so happy with the defence in front of him. He knows that he doesn't have to do much all game, and he's just delighted with them. And yeah, he can't praise them enough. And it's just, they've got Nakatani's got into the national team. I couldn't believe he was only 24 when I checked, but yeah, he's grown so much in the last couple of seasons. I'd still have Maruyama in there, even though he's 31. I can understand that they want to go for younger players, but Yonemoto's in as well. I'd be pushing Yoshida in that Japan team. I just think they're terrific, and they're one striker away from being a very, very good side. But I mean, we'll be asked every week, can Langerak do this clean sheet record? And I think it's almost looking certain at the moment, because every team they're up against, and it doesn't matter if they've got lots of attacking players or not, they're just not creating chances against Nagoya. And you'd expect Kashima, especially with the players that they've got, to be causing some problems. And if they can't, then, I mean, well, who can? I mean, we might get onto that when Kawasaki play them, because that is shaping up at the moment to be an absolutely terrific match.
Well, yeah, let's do it now then. So another question from Grant Frecce, who has clearly been crunching the numbers and is a lot better at maths than I am. He reckons that Mitch Langerak and his defence are on pace for 33 clean sheets now. So that's 5 in 6. So, yeah, he's got his calculator out and he reckons it's 33. Well, obviously, yeah, they're on pace for that. But his bigger question is, yeah, what's going to happen on May the 12th in match day 12 if these two teams carry on in similar veins? They might have the odd slip up here and there. Maybe Grampus have a game or two where they pay the price for not creating enough chances, and maybe they're held to a 0-0 or a 1-1 draw. But we're going to have to wait for it, obviously, Sam. If they played tomorrow in your back garden, how do you see the game going?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that it's not tomorrow. I'm glad that we've got a little bit more of a build-up, so these teams could really go on the various runs and really build up that contest. And, I mean, it is the kind of movable object, irresistible force kind of dynamic. And I have no idea how it would go, because Kawasaki, you expect to create chances against anyone. They've broken down every defence that's come up against them, and Nagoya have kept out every attack. So I have no idea. At the moment, I think it would be a letdown. It would be a 0-0. And that's not the greatest answer. I don't think of people building up this game. But I just think that's Nagoya defence. I just can't see them conceding the chances that Kawasaki sometimes need to score, because they do miss a few too many. And I think you have to take the one or two chances that Nagoya give you. And I mean, they're definitely capable of that, but yeah, that Nagoya defence, I think I always prefer a defence. I'm probably against 99% of the people listening, but I favour a defensive side over an attacking side. So I would side with Nagoya maybe, but I mean, it'd be a fantastic game. I really want to see it, and it's going to be a fantastic game. I don't know. That's not a great answer.
Well, no. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, so yesterday they've gone away to Kashima and they've had 38% possession. If a game away at Kawasaki follows a similar pattern, are they? I just don't think they're going to get away with it. Sooner or later, I think the dam will break, and I would hope that they would be a little bit more front foot. Although they don't have too much previous, at least so far this season, on taking the game to an opponent, especially away from home. But I would fear for Nagoya if the possession stat was of a similar. Similarly against them away at Kawasaki, I would just bank on Kawasaki's quality eventually breaking them down, as well organised as they are and as good as Langerak is. If I had to call it right now, I would say Kawasaki would narrowly shade it. But yeah, it would be fascinating. And as we've said a couple of times this season, Sam, teams that have gone at Kawasaki and put some pressure on them have not necessarily won the game, but they've shown that there is a vulnerability there. So if any team was going to have a crack at them, I would hope that Nagoya would want to take that on. But I can see, obviously, that their mentality is safety first and defence first, so maybe that's wishful thinking on my part.
Yeah, I can't see them taking the game to them. I think they'll play similarly to the way they did in the first game last season, where they got that 1-0 victory. Mm. And they're so comfortable playing, like they're happy with 38% possession. If anything, that might be a bit too much for them because they don't have the ball, but you don't ever think that they're in trouble. Kashima could have the ball for as long as they wanted in that game, but they didn't create any chances. And Nagoya have the players on the break in Mateus, in Soma, in Abe if he comes back. And they've got so many players that they have that bit of magic in them. So they're kind of happy to rely on that, I think. I think, and Picadenti is an old-style Italian coach. Away at Todoroki, I think he's happy with 0-0. He takes that all day long. So I think that would be their approach. I don't see them going toe-to-toe with them. I don't see them really going toe-to-toe with anyone. They're quite happy and content to be in their defensive mode. So, yeah, I don't expect a fireworks game, but it'd be a really interesting match.
Yeah, no question. All right, well, thanks again, Graham Freche. A couple more players I would like to touch on with you, Sam, before we move off this game. One is... came to us in a question from Johnny Nicol. It's the recently prolific Sho Inagaki. Johnny's wondering how his transfer from Hiroshima to Nagoya would rank amongst other transfers by J-League clubs in recent seasons.
Well, right up there for me. He doesn't have the impact, you'd say, going forward, as well, until this last few weeks, that you'd say, like, an Inaga, who would be the other one, you'd say, that's... probably the best in recent years. But Inagaki, the amount that he's given to this team defensively, the work he does that kind of goes unnoticed in that midfield, he does all the dirty work. You can tell that he's, like, I think he played all but about 12 minutes last year, and it was just the work he does, it's so vital to the way Nagoya play. I think he is no player, I don't think, has fitted a manager's profile of a midfielder more than Inagaki. I think it was so perfectly matched up. So, yeah, I struggle to think of anyone other than, you'd say, Inaga that would be a better signing within the league.
All right, and the other player I wanted to ask you about was Everaldo, of course, is so prolific, especially in the second half of last season when he finished a runner-up to Michael Olunga in the race for the Golden Boot and made the J1 best 11. He's gone six games at the start of this season and is yet to score. He has been unlucky at times. I know he's hit the woodwork on quite a few occasions. Of course, Kashima only played five games. Is he slightly off the boil at the moment, or it's just a matter of one will go in and then you'd expect them to come in a bunch for him, or is there a bit of second season syndrome behind his somewhat slow start?
Probably a bit of everything, and most of all my jinx after saying at the end of last season that he was almost just shoo-in for the Golden Boot this year. That's not quite happened. I think first few games he was definitely getting in the right positions and having his chances saved, or they come off the crossbar and he was getting a little bit unlucky. And then as that's gone on and the luck hasn't gone for him, I think his performances have got worse. Midweek, I mean, against Avispa, I think Douglas Groly just did a number on him, just followed him everywhere. Everaldo didn't really look like he was in the game. And this game, he's come up against another stern defence. I think he had maybe one half-chance header that went over the bar, but really just couldn't get into the game. And, it's just not quite clicking for him at the moment. But he didn't start last season very well either. And then we saw how well he ended it last year, scoring upwards of 20 goals. So he's got the quality, I'm pretty sure. Eventually you get one and then two, three, four will follow. So, I'm not going to rule out Everaldo at the moment. Hopefully, maybe even if it takes a League Cup game where he plays and he's against maybe lesser players, just gets a bit of confidence that way and starts scoring. But, it's not quite gone for him so far this season.
All right, then. All right, so, the games involving the top two in the table. Frontale, top of the pile, having played seven games so far. They have 19 points. Grampus, a perfect six wins from six. They have 18. We'll move on to, the latest candidate for game of the season, Sam. It was the only game played on Saturday in J1 this weekend. It had the whole day to itself, and if you watched it in full, you're probably still shaking your head at events at the Sapporo Dome after host Sapporo controversially went into a 3-0 lead and then shortly into the second half, and then Kobe roared all the way back and ultimately have claimed all 3 points thanks to braces from Hotaro Yamaguchi and Kyogo Furuhashi to cancel out Anderson Lopez's hat trick. Sam, what an epic.
Yeah, games at the Sapporo Dome early in the morning, for me anyway, never disappoint. They are always fantastic. Neither team defended well in this game, which is great because it just opens it up. I said at 3-0 that I put out on Twitter that it was game over, and much to Alan Gibson's delight, it wasn't. And he's been sure to remind me of that a few times. It was just, it had everything and nothing. Like, for the first 40 minutes, nothing happened. Mm. And then Sapporo got a penalty where Lucas Fernandez cuts across Sasaki, makes sure there's a bit of contact and goes down. Like, he absolutely buys it. And, yeah, they get away with it, that one. Then the second one, I'm sure we'll discuss these in detail later, but they then get another penalty, which there's a hint of handball from Fukumori, and then he's fouled. Like, the defending before that is terrible, and they get themselves into awful positions, Kobe. But Sapporo kind of benefit from it, get the 2-0 lead before half-time. Look so comfortable at the start of the second half, where they go 3-0 up. And then they just, because Misha Petrovic has no defence button, they just keep going forward. And they just cause themselves so many problems, and they were just so open. And the goalkeeper at Nakano had an awful game. His kicking out from the back was poor. He was just, just too involved. He was trying to come out for everything he could. He conceded a penalty. Tanaka then played a terrible back pass, and they just shot themselves in the foot. But Kobe showed a kind of resilience that they have done all season, where they've fallen behind in games or against Tokyo when they got pulled back to 2-2 and then went on to win it. And they just, they were really good, actually, second half, Kobe. And it's a kind of remarkable turnaround from them, because last season, if they got into that position, they'd just have folded, and that would be that. And kind of that's how it's been for Kobe for a while. But their second half performance was really good. Yamaguchi, I thought, was fantastic in that midfield, and Furuhashi as well. And they looked less like a team that wants to just pass the ball and keep possession for a while without going anywhere. They actually went forward quickly and played the ball early, and they really benefited from that. And Sapporo just, they collapsed second half. But, it had absolutely everything. And these refereeing decisions, they caused a lot of debate, especially in our Patreon line group as the game was happening.
Most certainly did. So, after a week's hibernation, it is back. Listeners, it's time for This Week in VAR. This Week in VAR. This Week. Okay, Sam, so, there are two huge decisions in the game. Just before half-time. Well, the first one is, a couple of minutes before the 45 are up, and then the second one is well and truly into stoppage time. Both are penalties awarded to Sapporo. There's major question marks over both. Both are ultimately converted by Anderson Lopez, who, by the by, then went on to complete his hat-trick at 21 seconds into the second half. But yes, we're here to talk about the initial decisions by the referee and whether the VAR displayed a lack of cojones and not overruling the referee here. As you say, Lucas Fernandez made sure of the contact from Daiju Sasaki. If you're looking at that in proper replays, Sam, you can pick that out, can't you? So you wonder whether the VAR has decided that's not a clear and obvious error. That has to be the only reason it's not been overturned.
Yeah, that's what I think for this, because the referee in his position, I mean, it looks like, because Sasaki's tracking him back, it looks like he catches him, which he does. And you can certainly see why the referee is given a penalty in normal time. So the VAR has to look at that and say, who's connected, who's caused that contact? And it's quite clearly it's Lucas that's done it. But I just think they've just said, oh, there is contact, we can't overrule this because it's not completely 100% a wrong decision. So they've gone with it. So they've just gone with the referee's decision. So I think they're a bit soft on that. I can understand why they've kept the decision, but I think in most other leagues you'd expect that to be overturned.
Right, and so what about the second one then? Again, as I said, it came with the stoppage time well and truly underway at the end of the first half. Akito Fukumori is tripped by Tetsushi Yamakawa as he looks to play the ball after he's controlled a free kick deep into the box. But did he handle it before there was contact from Yamakawa? It looked to me that he did. Did he handle it in the wrong part of his arm/elbow/sleeve? Or, to me, the VAR is a little bit weak here and not overturning this, because that looked like a handball by Fukumori, which obviously would have cancelled out the fact that Yamakawa has then made contact with him. So, again, where did you sit on that one?
Yeah, this one I think is a little bit more contentious. I think first and foremost, just watching it firsthand, I thought it was a handball. So I think the referee should have spotted it and then not given. They should have given the free kick at the start. But then, like, I've gone frame by frame on this to see exactly where it hits Fukumori, and it hits him kind of half on his sleeve, half on the top of his arm. And the way that the new handball rules is, if you've seen any Premier League game where they're doing lines for offside, they take it from the end of the sleeve. So that's not handball if it hits that. So because I think it's hit half and half, they've decided it's not a completely clear and obvious error that it's definitely hit only arm and not sleeve. But that's why they've not gone with it. I think that is the only reason these decisions aren't being overturned, is because the VAR is looking for absolute clear cut. The referee on the pitch made a wrong decision. So I think that's what they're going with it. I thought it was handball live. I think it should be given as handball, but if I'm going to be as kind to the VAR as possible, I can understand why they've just allowed it to go with the on-field decision.
All right, so we do have a couple more VAR incidents to come a little bit later. But, let's celebrate Kobe's fight back in the second half then, Sam. As I say, after Lopez had scored his third of the game 21 seconds after the restart, Hotaru Yamaguchi blasted past Kojiro Nakano in the 53rd minute. Kyogo Furuhashi pounced on a dreadfully mishit back pass that Sam mentioned earlier and took the ball around Nakano before finishing from a tight angle 4 minutes later. Then Furuhashi finished off his brace from the penalty spot when he equalised after Nakano had brought down Sasaki, who had obviously bounced back nicely from the disappointment of having conceded the penalty at the end of the first half. And it was Sasaki who laid the winner on a plate for Yamaguchi in the 86th minute, Sam. He did superbly down the right and cut the ball back for Yamaguchi to score a brilliant winner with a first-time curler from inside the D. So, you mentioned how much credit Kobe deserve for their fight back, and, they did score some terrific goals as well.
Yeah, really good goals, and Sasaki's work for that goal for Yamaguchi was fantastic. He's been a player that's kind of been on the radar for Kobe for a while. He had like a random loan spell at Palmeiras a couple of years ago and has come back. Last season he featured very briefly in the ACL a couple of games, but he's a player of real quality, and the run that he did, the way he got past Miyazawa, then again past Kim, I think it was, and then just the vision to pull the ball back to Yamaguchi. It's terrific football, and Yamaguchi tucked it away well. I mean, I think the goalkeeper probably should do better, as the ball kind of goes in the centre of the goal, but take nothing away from Yamaguchi. It was the second of his two goals. He played like the talisman role in this game, like just kind of grabbed his team by the neck, pushed them forward, and he was kind of at the start of attacks, he was at the end of attacks, he was just, pretty much everywhere. And it was just a really refreshing performance from Kobe, because so many times we've sat here and just kind of complained that they just, they have the ball, but they don't do anything with it. And this time they were forced into it by the game situation, but they just went for it. They went for quick balls forward. Furuhashi was terrific going forwards. Just the runs weren't made. Nakasaka on the other side, he came on at half time, and they just looked a real threat. And I think it was a really good, really, really good performance from Kobe. But Sapporo as well, Petrovic, I love Misha Petrovic. His football is, the games are really good to watch when a Constantine play, but there's no way you should be losing from 3-0 down. You've got to try and see the game out, but they have no setting to kind of revert and have and hold what they've got. And it's cost them, this isn't the first time it's cost them, and it was really poor from them. That's just, it must be a frustrating team to watch if you're a Sapporo fan.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, so again, before we move off this game, another question from Graham Freche, this time about Sapporo. Sam, Graham Freche says he likes Consadole, he loves Misha. Besides sublime defensive and goal-tending performances, I guess sublime in the disappointing version here, Consadole seems to be on a standstill. Do you think Misha, who has apparently signed a 5-year contract, do you think he can still get them to the next level, or do you think his formation, his 3-4-2-1 football, is outdated and things need to change? I mean, you hope they don't change because you're loving getting up watching them on a weekly basis. But in terms of taking the club forward, I mean, you know, I said in pre-season I thought they'd stagnated. I wasn't expecting games like this to be a regular occurrence. But, I don't know. What do you think in relation to Graham Freche's points and question there?
Yeah, I do think they're just staying where they are and stagnating, as you said. Like, Petrovic gets teams to a certain level, but he's never really been able to take them to league titles or anything like that. And since they got to fourth place a couple of years ago, they've just kind of settled into a mid-table team. I think they're just, as much as like his formation and his philosophy and the way that his team play is terrific to watch. It's so good. But there are so many limitations to it. Defensively, they're just going to get caught like this against good teams, and it's been an Achilles heel of his teams for ages, but he doesn't seem to ever want to rectify it, and because he's not going to do that, this team I don't think can go be an ACL challenger or can't maybe not even in the top half of the league, because they're just going to shoot themselves in the foot, and especially when they're not replenishing the squad with new players, it's just kind of youngsters that are coming in, that's just going to contribute to the errors a little bit more while they develop. So yeah, I just don't see a Petrovic team at least the Sapporo team going anywhere. And maybe they're quite happy, I suppose, if they're just going to... I don't think they're relegation candidates at all. So if they're happy with just staying as a J1 team, then great. But yeah, in terms of any progression, I don't really see it. But yeah, keep him, because there's no team I'd rather watch at 4 a.m.
Terrific stuff. All right, we've done the game slightly out of order here, but obviously this blockbuster deserved a higher billing than you would otherwise imagine, considering where the teams are situated in the table. But yeah, this win sees Kobe seventh in the table, while Sapporo have slipped down to 14th. The teams that came into the match day in third and fourth, Tosu and Cerezo, remain in those positions, despite both having played 0-0 draws in match day 6. We mentioned it in this week in VAR that Sam was broadly of the opinion that VAR just about got things right with those two debatable penalty decisions in the Sapporo game. Sam, I'm not sure where you stand, though, on the goal that was disallowed for Tosu here in the 68th minute of a game that, again, from the highlights, it looks like Tosu utterly dominated. They had over 70% possession, which, again, if you had have said in pre-season that Tosu were going to do that in any game at all this year, I would have been sending you off to the funny farm. But, early season darlings have carried on here. But, hugely unfortunate, at least from my vantage point here, to have had a goal disallowed, and especially of a goal of such remarkable quality as well. Toshio Shimakawa has played the ball out to the right. The right back Nanase Ino has produced a brilliant volleyed cross that Fuchi Honda has headed in from 6 yards. But the linesman flagged that Ino was offside. Replay suggested he was level, but VAR did not overrule. What say you?
Well, first and foremost, if someone produces that quality, how can you as a linesman put your flag up and try and rule that out? It's so good, the volley. I mean, the technique, incredible. And I've looked at this again. I didn't think it was offside when I first saw it. I've done it frame by frame again, and I think he's level. I don't think he's offside. And the thing is that...
He's never offside in a million years. Oh, no way. Yeah.
I don't think so. And everyone hates the lines that get brought up in the Premier League, but at least that shows you what the VAR has seen. And if that line happens to show that he's slightly offside, then you can sort of accept, okay, he's offside technically, and it's not very fun, but yeah, we can see why the decision has been made. But to anyone looking at that, it looks like he's onside or at the very worst level, and you've just denied a terrific goal. So yeah, I can't accept it. I don't like it at all. And it just seems very unfair that that sort of goal is cut out for what must be, if it is offside, and we have to assume that the VAR has looked at it closely and they have been able to determine that it's offside. So I guess we have to just accept it, but it leaves a bitter taste in the mouth to see that sort of goal ruled out for what can only be the barest of margins.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm just not having it at all. I'm thinking about sending this linesman a bill for the nail polish remover I'm going to have to buy tomorrow, because I used the wrong kind of marker on my screen, Sam, when I was drawing lines. I've accidentally used a permanent marker, and now I've got a huge black line across my computer screen at work. But, yeah, never in a million years. He's level at worst. He's absolutely onside, as clear as day, as far as I'm concerned. And this, to me, might have been an occasion where VAR didn't want to be seen to be overruling the on-field official, because it makes him look bad, basically. As you say, he's had the gall to raise his flag after one of the great goals of the season, and then the VAR doesn't want to embarrass him in front of however many people were at the real estate agent in front of the station stadium. Yeah, this is highway robbery here. Tosu have deserved this victory, and unfortunately for Fukuoka supporters are happy because they've ended up with a point. But this is a wrong decision, and I fear that this is a result of something that we talked about and have been asked about several times already this year, and it's VAR not wanting to embarrass the on-field officials by making them admit that they've got it wrong, quite frankly.
Yeah, if that is the case, it turns out that way, it's completely unacceptable, because offside is either offside or it's onside. There's no subjectivity to it. It's no just, you can't cover the decision. It's either right or it's wrong. So if anyone is watching the J-League Judge replay, which has been geo-blocked in the UK now, could they please send me or tell me what the result is of this if they look at it? Because there's just no way that if it's onside, it looks like they should be pulling it out. I mean, it's just a horrible decision in my opinion. And I really hope that it's not just, you can't settle into this situation where you won't overturn any decision. Otherwise, what's the point of having the system if you're not going to use it to overrule a refereeing decision? That's the whole reason it's there. So yeah, just stop us waiting around for 2.5 minutes to wait for a non-decision if they're never, ever going to change anything.
Fair enough. I think we both said our piece there. And, otherwise then, Tosu haven't been able to break down Fukuoka, Sam, despite that huge possession advantage, an advantage in the shot count, which is even more lopsided from the official J-League account or website to Google than normal. The J-League site had it 9-2 in favour of Tosu. The Google result is 16-7, so goodness knows who's watching this game and taking shots down. I mean, somebody might have nodded off for 10 minutes or something on the J-League website side of things, but I'm not sure. But anyway, it looks like Tosu have utterly dominated this, and do Fukuoka deserve credit for that chance? An early Eduardo free kick that Masaaki Murakami saved diving away to his right. But otherwise, were Fukuoka pretty much able to keep them at arm's length despite that huge possession disadvantage?
Relatively, yeah. I'm going to give Avispa a lot of credit, actually, because I don't think I've given them their due in recent weeks. I thought, especially midweek, they were so good at keeping Everaldo and everyone else at bay. And in this game, they should have conceded, they should have lost. But Murakami makes a lot of good saves in this game, much maligned by me and many others, but he did his job very well. Defending, they had a few chances, Tosu, but nothing completely clear cut. It wasn't like they should have definitely scored a goal in this game. I thought Avispa to a degree kept them chances from long range or kept them with kind of difficult chances. I think Douglas Groley is really growing on me as a defender. I mean, I always had a soft spot from him from when I used to watch Brazilian football. He came from Chapecoense and he scored this outrageous volley as a centre-half. So he's already lived long in my memory, and defensively, in the last few games, he has been right on it. And Avispa as a whole, they are defending very well. They've got because they've not got a striker at the moment, really, because Bruno Mendes is out and Wanmar is out. So they've been playing Mikuni, the young, I think, like 20-year-old centre-back. He's been playing up front. And so for them to have managed to get a win over Kashima and then a draw against this high-flying Tosu while playing a 20-year-old centre-back up front, I think that's full credit to them. I don't think we could have asked for much more from them. So, yeah, I'm really happy for them. They've got a big derby game as well for these two teams. So, yeah, credit to Avispa for hanging on to this. But I think Tosu, well, obviously blame the officials, but they will feel a little bit hard done to because they were the better team and did create the better chances.
Yeah, all right. Well, it just carries on the remarkable start to the season for Tosu. It's six played and remarkably no goals conceded. That is absolutely stunning. Obviously, we've been paying a huge amount of credit to Nagoya Grampus for their run of clean sheets. It's five in a row since opening day. Well, yeah, obviously, Tosu are doing the one better at the moment, yet to concede at all this season. So we'll wait and see if that run will continue after the international break. Also during 0-0, this time away from home, were Cerezo Osaka. They travelled to Shonan Bellmare, where both keepers in this game were beaten in the first half, but had somewhat fortunate reprieves. For the second time this season, Naoki Yamada's arm cost Shonan a goal. Way back in match day one, Tatsuya Okamoto's follow-up was disallowed when Yamada's shot deflected off a defender and hit his arm. In the 20th minute on Sunday, Yamada bundled in via his arm after his initial shot hit a sliding defender. Then in the 38th minute, Yuta Toyokawa scuffed his volley from 25 yards and Kosei Tani was relieved to see the ball come back off the post. Otherwise, it looked like a pretty decent performance, at least from the highlights, from Shonan, Sam. Yuki Ohashi in particular looked busy. He was a bit of a running battle with Kim Jin-hyun in the Cerezo net. Unfortunately for Ohashi and his Bellmare teammates, he wasn't able to win that battle on the day. But it looked to me, again, from the highlights, that Shonan pretty much shaded this one.
Yeah, I definitely thought they were the better team in this game. It was a game that was really affected by the weather. I think this was probably the one worst affected. Neither team necessarily got to their fluent best. But yeah, the chances were all coming Shonan's way. And I just think if they had a proper striker, or maybe this Wellington Jr. comes in, then they would have won this game quite comfortably, because Ohashi got into the positions so often, but his finishing wasn't good enough. It was... I don't think Kim had to make a really stunning save to deny him. I think everything was pretty comfortable, but they looked really good. Some of the football they played, Nago, as I think we mentioned a lot, Scott definitely did in the preview, he's come into this team the last few games. He's giving them a little bit of quality that they've not always had. And yeah, they just kind of were easily the better team in this game. Like, Cerezo didn't create too much besides that Toyokawa strike that you mentioned off the post. And yeah, so Shonan kept them very quiet at the back, and just, yeah, a little bit more quality in front of goal, and I think they would have won this game. But that's kind of the main area that they're lacking, so the foreign players can't get into the country soon enough for them. But I think there are good signs there for Shonan. They don't look like the team that they were last year, where they just kind of got cut adrift pretty quickly and then didn't ever look like they'd get out of the what would have been relegation places. But this year there's a lot more to them, I think, so they're definitely not shoo-ins for relegation at all. They've got a lot of good players.
Yeah, good stuff. So, positive from Shonan here. Unfortunately for them, they weren't able to, as I said, beat Kim Jin-hyun. But, a positive performance to take into the international break for Cerezo, slightly underwhelming display, but another clean sheet for them. And, they'll move on, as I say, still fourth in the table. Closing the gap on the top four over the weekend, well, at least to the teams in third and fourth, were Sanfrecce Hiroshima, who returned from Oita, not a especially long trip from Hiroshima over to northeastern Kyushu to face Oita Trinita. And yes, they've returned with all 3 points after a 3-1 victory. They had to come from behind as well. And those gasps you heard, listeners, at about 3:10 on Sunday afternoon were from Sam, stunned that Shun Nagasawa had scored his first Trinita goal, heading in a pinpoint cross from Yuto Misao 7 minutes into the second half. Sam, I guess he just couldn't miss, could he?
No, but I'm going to give him a credit because I think he met this cross very well. The header, it's what he does best if he does anything well. I mean, it's these headers, and he had the beating of the defender, headed it. There was no real chance for Osako, so I'm going to give him a lot of credit. I think it's a good header for him, and we'll settle our beef for 1 week at least.
Very good, very good. He'll be wrapped with that, I'm sure. Yes, that goal came after both teams had hit the woodwork in the first half. Hiroshima striker Douglas Vieira headed a cross from the right against the bar in the 36th minute, and then 2 minutes later, Kenta Fukumori's driven cross in from the left came back off the far post. So Nagasawa gave host Trinita the lead 7 minutes after the break, but then veteran midfielder Toshihiro Aoyama headed in himself in the 66th minute to equalise for Sanfrecce. Then there was some late drama and a late disappointment for Oita when the excellent, always excellent, Hayao Kawabe drove through their keeper Shun Takagi's legs from the edge of the box after a surging run out of defence from Yuta Imazu. That was terrific from Imazu, and Kawabe did superbly to finish. And then the substitute, Shun Ayukawa, put the icing on the cake for Hiroshima in stoppage time when he fired past Takagi after fellow substitute Tsukasa Morishima had won the ball back deep in the Oita half. So, Hiroshima going along fairly nicely here, Sam. They moved up a spot in the table from sixth to fifth, and a good come from behind victory. They'll be very happy with that.
Yeah, a little under the radar. They've kind of become like this kind of consistent team. They've not lost yet. They're winning games when they're falling behind or not playing particularly well. And I still think there are issues with them. I think at the back they're still not the finished article. But yeah, this was a really good come from behind victory, I thought. As always, they rely, I think, quite heavily on Aoyama and Kawabe, especially in midfield, and those two were the players that kind of got them back into it. I really liked the Aoyama header off the underside of the bar. I think I can't remember Aoyama actually scoring headers like this, so yeah, that was really good to see. And Kawabe's, his burst through midfield, he's been called up to the Japan national team side, and yeah, fully deserved, because he has been superb for Hiroshima ever since he joined from Jubilo. And yeah, he was on loan at Jubilo, wasn't he? So that's kind of where I saw him, but he's always looked like a very good player, and yeah, I'm glad he's got his chance. And yeah, I felt a little bit for Oita, because they obviously took the lead and they were in this game for long periods. They got a little bit unlucky, but eventually Hiroshima just broke them down and took advantage of a little bit of sloppy play towards the end, I thought, with the third goal that kind of ended this tie. But yeah, I'll give credit to Hiroshima. They played very well. Imatsu, who came in, I mean, I think he was playing at right back at this point in the game, because that back line is changing all the time. They decided to go four at the back without actually owning left or right backs, which has been an issue. But Imatsu was there for this bit, and then he kind of cuts inside. It's a really good run from him past a few players, and then gets that pass away. So, yeah, a really nice goal. So, yeah, Hiroshima, I think, not playing particularly well necessarily in every game, but they're unbeaten and going, and they're only going to get better. So, yeah, really good signs for them.
Indeed, and you might have gone a decent way towards answering Graham Fritche's question about them, Sam, in your last answer there. But obviously, Graham Fritsche, the second half of his handle, suggests that he also has a soft spot for Hiroshima. So he says, after a horrible start against Vigalta, they slowly climbed the ladder. Of course, for listeners who don't remember, on the opening day, Sun Frecce were pegged back at the death by a 10-man Vigalta Sendai and ultimately had to settle for a 1-1 draw. Graham Frecce says he still doesn't know what to make of them this year, especially since they aren't the most pretty to watch. But, as you have just said there, Sam, but they get the job done. What do you guys make of them so far? So, well, I guess when you're fifth after six games, yeah, you're doing something right. And, again, it doesn't always have to be flashy, does it? And Hiroshi Jofuku sides don't tend to be to begin with. So they've definitely given themselves a platform, haven't they, Sam? And whether they'll ultimately end up this high in the table, well, obviously is a long way to go, but yeah, all you can do is, as you said as yourself there, undefeated. Graham Fritsche made that point as well. Yeah, make yourself hard to beat first and foremost, and then, yeah, results like this one on Sunday, a few more of them, the confidence really starts to pick up, and I suppose you don't know where how high it can take you, do you?
No, they're going along fairly nicely. It's definitely not pretty, because I think they are trying to be a bit more expansive, but don't really know how to do it, and they're trying to learn as they go. And like their attacking players, they're trying very hard, and things aren't always coming off, but they're getting a few lucky breaks, which is good for them. And yeah, as you say, if they keep winning games, it's going to build confidence. And you just think there is more to come from this team in an attacking sense, because we haven't really seen a lot from Junior Santos, but we know from last season that when given chances, he's going to score you goals. And they kind of having to, this whole period of games where we've played, what is it, six games in less than a month. So there's like lots of games being played. They've had to rotate their players a lot, especially in attacking areas. So it's not quite clicked for them. But for them to have got through this period unbeaten with the points they've got can only be a positive. So I think once they kind of settle into this way of playing, I think they'll do a lot. They'll do quite well. And to have got this base is really positive for them. And I think a few people picked Hiroshima as kind of outsiders for Champions League spots this season. And it's not looking like the worst bet at all, actually, because I think they'll only improve from here on. So, yeah, I think a lot of positives for them. Just they need to figure out or find some fullbacks, because that is their area of concern. And if they do that, then who knows? They might be Champions League contenders. But, yeah, a lot of positives for them.
Yeah, terrific stuff. All right, so, yeah, Hiroshima, Kobe, and FC Tokyo all moved above Yokohama F. Marinos in the table over the weekend in match day six. That's because the Yokohama's scheduled game, of course, away at Gunma Osaka, was postponed. That is the last game of March that Gunma were scheduled to play. So we all being well, they will return to action away in Hiroshima, actually, as it happens in match day seven at the start of April. So yes, F. Marinos were off this weekend, and that might have been a good thing, because there were a couple of players that tested positive for COVID-19. Sam, as a bit of an aside, before we move on to the last three games, that's obviously hugely worrying. And I guess the postponement happened at just the right time for F. Marinos, you could say.
Yeah, pretty fortunate for the league and their schedulers. So, no real details are being given out. They're just two players. Don't think any of them have got any symptoms or whatnot. So, hopefully, they've been isolated pretty quickly. It's not going to spread elsewhere. Hopefully, it's been contained, and those players, yeah, can make swift and full recoveries. Because, yeah, there was that one. There was also at Kashiwa as well, where they announced after the game had kicked off that they'd had a player test positive. So it seems like they have gone through all the correct protocols and whatnot, and everything was above board. But yeah, it's always a little worrying when you get these sorts of pockets come up, because it's kind of the damage it's done to Gamba's season already is like going to be quite huge, and it's going to last. They're going to have ramifications for the rest of the season. So I think these are maybe lucky escapes this weekend, where nothing has been affected too badly by it, just as long as the players concerned can recover quickly.
Indeed. Well, speaking of COVID-19, it appears that FC Tokyo had a couple of protocol breaches in the build-up to this game, and that is why their first-choice goalkeeper, Gol Hatano, and their 2020 Player of the Season, Shuto Abe, were left out of the matchday squad for Sunday's visit of Vegalta Sendai. The story goes that protocols were breached, so the two players were left out as a precaution, while talisman Leandro was also absent, apparently due to injury. Tokyo hosted Sendai, who had been giving up goals for fun to opponents basically since that opening day draw away at Hiroshima, but typically, and no good for my fingernails, Sam, unfortunately FC Tokyo did not join that that goal-scoring party, although they did score two excellent goals. They had to come from behind to claim all 3 points, and Sendai proved to be much more stubborn visitors than they had been on some of their recent travels.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, how are your nerves doing as a Tokyo supporter this season? Because often you've just kind of coasted along and they've not been the greatest games, but every game this year seems to be some sort of belter, and it must be getting the heart racing for all Tokyo fans. Yeah, are you dealing with it okay?
Well, it's not great. As I said, my fingernails are down to the quick again. But just for once, you would like to see Tokyo do the done thing and actually put a... an ordinary-looking visiting team away, but that's just not the way we do things, unfortunately. But never a dull moment, I suppose, and that's not something you can say over the course of the last 4 or 5 years under Kenta Hasegawa. So I guess all's well that ends well, but it almost didn't, I guess we're indebted to a decent display by not even backup, the third choice goalkeeper, of course, because Akihiro Hayashi is normally the first choice when he's available, but Tsuyoshi Kodama stepped in and actually did very well in Hatano's absence, and he will have gotten a big round of applause, I'm sure, from his teammates when they all got back to the change rooms. As I said, Tokyo had to come from behind. They had spurned some early chances with Joan Omari and Hirotaka Mita, the guilty parties, and then Koji Hachisuka powered home a header from a corner straight off the training ground in the 24th minute. Tsuyoshi Watanabe was left floundering on the floor, and Hachisuka powered home his header, as I said. But just 160 seconds later, Tokyo were level. So, they fought straight back, and it was Kyosuke Tagawa who got the leveler. An absolute belter it was as well. He played a 1-2 with Masato Morishige in midfield, drove forward and blasted in a brilliant left-footed strike from 25 yards to celebrate his call-up to the national under-24 squad in some style. There was another question, Sam, from Patreon, from Gabriel Anello, about Tagawa, wondering whether this might be finally his breakthrough season. He scored, I think it's 3 already in the league this year, and the first couple maybe weren't highlight reel quality goals, but this was an absolute special. Anytime, obviously, you beat Jakub Slobik from distance, you're doing something right. And Tagawa's goal, it was absolutely brilliant, wasn't it? From basically dead in front, but it was one of those rare goals that actually curls into the side netting as it makes its way in. It was, fantastic strike.
Yeah, there's a lot to like about this goal, even just the build-up to start with, the kind of 1-2 with Morishige, and then the way he so positively drives forward at the defence, forces them to back off, gets himself that space to release that shot, and it has to be a very good effort to beat Slovic, and it was. It was a really good goal, and it's capped off what's been a very good start to the season for him. It could well be his breakthrough season. He's threatened it a few times before, I thought. There was that one season, maybe his last one at Tosu, where he started that season very well, but then kind of tailed off. And I don't think it's quite happened for him so far at Tokyo, but he's got himself into the team this season, and maybe just through rotation, Nagai not being fit, issues with Diego's fitness as well, and Leandro. So he's taken those chances very well and got himself into the national team. And he fully deserves it. And even Watanabe as well, those two have come in, and the best credit I can give to them is that you don't necessarily notice that Leandro or Nagai are not there, because they're creating chances, they're putting chances away. And this was a really good goal from Tagawa, and it's kind of stopped any nerves creeping into the Tokyo performance to score a goal, as good a goal like that, almost straight away.
Yes, indeed. And then, so 2 minutes before half-time, Diego Oliveira gave a reminder of his class when he took a pass from Keigo Higashi, nutmegged Shimao Mate, and then stroked a superb finish across Jakub Slovic to send the Gasmen into half-time ahead. So another question from Gab. He's piggybacking off the two Tokyo goal scorers here. He says that, obviously, Diego Oliveira is an amazing player. Can we say he's been one of the best foreign players the J-League has ever seen, quality-wise? That is a huge, huge call. I mean, this is a terrific goal from Oliveira. I think 14 is the best he's ever done in his time at Tokyo, Sam. 14 in a season. That was obviously 2019 when Tokyo finished second behind Yokohama F. Marinos. Before that, though, obviously he was surplus to requirements at Kashiwa, which saw him come to Tokyo on loan in the first place. I think in terms of best foreign players that FC Tokyo have ever had, he would be in a short list. He'd definitely be in the top five of that. But in terms of the best foreign players, I mean, you're looking at any position on the pitch. I don't think I could rate him that highly, and that's coming from an FC Tokyo supporter. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a strong shout, that, because there's that one season that Kashiwa here did nothing and just got dropped from the squad. And then last season, I think he was pushed out of position a little bit too much. Mm. But, yeah, he wasn't quite at his best. I think there are seasons and there have been years where Diego has looked a very good player. And I think he is a good player and would be in that top 10% of the league, of foreign players in the league. But, yeah, I wouldn't go that far. When you've got players like... The one I would say that in just terms of longevity and consistency is Leo Silva. I just think the way he's done it for so long and kept his level so high, going from Albrecht then up to Kashima, I think that sort of player is the one I'd be considering that type, as in the best J-League foreign player that there's been. And I think Diego just consistently isn't quite up at that level, but he's been a fantastic player for FC Tokyo and a timely reminder of his quality in this game.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. So thanks, Gab, for your two questions about Tokyo players. Always happy to receive them. Tokyo went into halftime with a 2-1 advantage thanks to Tagawa and Diego Oliveira. 9 minutes after the break, Diego's fellow Brazilian, Adailton, should really have given Tokyo some breathing room, but he toe-poked over after a surge into the box. And then there was another this week in VAR candidate on the hour, Sam, when Takumi Masai's shot deflected off Ryoya Ogawa and out for a corner. Not especially the fact that the correct decision was given on the pitch and then confirmed by VAR, but the fact that it took 3.5 minutes for it all to go down and for the initial decision to stand, as I say, correctly, but for it to take that long for them to decide that the ball had deflected off Ogawa's knee and had brushed his elbow on the way out, I don't know, seemed excessive. And then the fact that the referee allowed Tokyo to make a substitution that took another 30 seconds out of the game straight after, it just kind of killed the game flat for about 5 or 6 minutes, didn't it?
Yeah, this will be forever my biggest bugbear with VAR, especially if you're going by the mantra of clear and obvious. If you can't see it in about 30 seconds or a minute at maximum, it's not clear and obvious, so just play on. I mean, you can tell from this, the rule is, with the new handball rule, which I understand perhaps they've gone into the rule book to figure out what the new handball rule is this week, but that might be the way why it's taken so long. But because it deflects on his knee onto his hand, it can't be given as handball because there's nothing he can do about it. So they should have seen that straight away and just play on. I don't really know why everything has to take so long, because, yeah, all it does is it frustrates everyone watching. It just, you're all sitting there, people in the crowd probably don't even know that there's a VAR check going on, then, unless they've spotted the referee and put into his ear. But, yeah, it's just really frustrating, and they need to quicken this process up, because it does put off people, and especially if you get a casual viewer that is coming in to watch the J-League for the first time, and then they're sitting around and for some reason they've stopped for 3-4 minutes and no one really understands. It's not going to get people into the game, so yeah, it really needs to be sorted.
Indeed. Well, yeah, so it stayed 2-1 to Tokyo, and then all the way into stoppage time when the Sendai substitute Chihiro Kato planted a free header from Martinez's corner on target, but Diego Oliveira, positioned on the near post, thumped the ball off the line and to safety, and Tokyo were finally able to exhale at the full-time whistle and, bank another 3 points. Obviously, we've been very, justifiably harsh in our criticism of Sendai here, since the opening day, Sam. I was frustrated as a Tokyo supporter that they didn't make more of their opportunities and win this game more comfortably. But I can also look at the other side of things and say that Sendai were improved here. A good goal from, as I said, straight off the training ground. They're going to need goals like those, aren't they? I think they did show an overall lack of quality going forward, but again, they could have still nicked something again at the death. So they didn't drop their heads. They kept on going until the full-time whistle, and on another day, if Diego Oliveira was on the opposite post, then they would have finished with a point.
Yeah, I think it was, as you say, an improved performance. They battled, they showed fight. I don't think they showed much quality defensively. There was that one chance where Dalton got in because Mate just let a ball go under his foot. And there were far too many examples of that, but they did go forward. I think the chance and the goal they scored, I think Tokyo have got to defend that better because it gets through a long way. I think maybe it was Ogawa was underneath it. I don't necessarily want to pick on him if it's not him, but I think it just comes a long way and someone should have attacked it before it gets to Hachiska. And then I think Watanabe might have slipped as well as he was going for it. So it was one where I think Tokyo should have done better, and they should have done better with the one that eventually Diego clears off the line. So yeah, I think they didn't really create anything in terms of open play, and they didn't really look like they were going to either. And it is hard to see where goals are going to come from in this Sendai team. So credit to them for continuing to go, but yeah, it's hard to see where they're going to get victories from.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, so we've got two games left to review. Both ended in 2-1 wins, and we're going to celebrate to Tokushima Vortis because they finally have a win to celebrate on their return to J1. This was in the very definition of a relegation dogfight 6-pointer against Cellar Dwellers Yokohama FC. A game that Tokushima simply had to win. Again, still with their Spanish coach Danny Poyatos is still not allowed into the country, or at least not on the touchline for this game. But he will have been very proud, I'm sure, watching on of his side, Sam, because they were finally able to bank 3 points. A game that followed a similar pattern of Vorta's game so far this season. They took the lead, they were pegged back, but this time they actually went on and won it themselves and claimed all 3 points.
Yeah, I'm very happy for them because they have been playing quite well and not getting the results that they maybe deserved in games. And this game, they finally took advantage of being the better team and got that winner because once Yokohama equalised, you kind of worry from them if they're thinking, oh, here we go again. But yeah, they were still positive. They kept going, kept playing their football. And I thought they were quite comfortably the better team in this game. Yokohama again didn't play very well. There's not much to be positive about for them, but for Tokushima, I thought there were quite a few good performances. Masaki Watai was back after his concussion from his own teammate hitting a free kick against him, and he looked really good. He not started too many games so far this season for whatever reason, but he just added a little bit of quality. I mean, he was played through early on. I think it was Konishi who'd come into midfield, played a glorious ball over the top, which Watai, I think, was denied by Rokotan. And then it was him that got in for the winning goal, the way he just burst forward, slips between the lines, then played that perfect through pass through for Miyashiro. So it was just that bit of quality he added. it was kind of the difference between the sides. And Takashima, once they get him playing a bit more regularly, once Nishiya comes back, who's was arguably their best player last season, maybe just behind Iwao, if he comes back on the left wing, then, yeah, it opens up a few more options for Takashima. And they've got players that are going to score goals. Miyashiro took his goal so well to win this game. So you can see that there are bits of quality in this Takashima side, where if you look at Yokohama, I mean, the first Takashima goal kind of sums up how their season's going. The cross comes in, it evades everyone, but Sugimoto backing up at the back post makes sure that there's a goal scored heading into his own net. So, yeah, I mean, tough times for Yokohama, but really positive for Takashima.
Well, yeah, terrific header from Sugimoto. Just such a shame it was past insurance salesman Yuji Rokutan. But yeah, so that was Takashima taking the lead just before half time. Just before the hour, Yokohama FC centre back Yutaro Hakamata, who has had a pretty rough start to the year, and yeah, he's drawn a few mentions on the podcast already for some shoddy performances. He went some way towards redeeming himself with a towering header from a Tatsuki Seko corner back across Naoto Kami Fukumoto and inside the far poster to draw the visitors level. But yes, as Sam says, Masaki Watai played in Taisei Miyashiro in the 73rd minute. And yeah, at the fourth time of asking, the fourth time this season that Vortis have taken the lead in their six games, well, yeah, the first time they were able to actually go on and take all 3 points, and that moves them up above the likes of Urawa Reds, Sapporo, and Kashima Antlers, and all the way up to 12th, the giddy heights of 12th in the table. So, yeah, congratulations to Vortis, a first win of the season. They're still the trailing fellow promoted side of Fukuoka, of course, but, yeah, both of those two teams doing okay in the early running in 10th and 12th. Fukuoka adjusted to, yeah, two spots above their fellow promoted side. And, well, Yokohama FC, again, probably the less said about them, the better. But Graham Fritche is back for more. And, again, we appreciate his, yeah, terrific range of questions on five different J1 clubs this week. It's absolutely terrific. But, yeah, it's not rosy at all for Yokohama FC, is it, Sam? And Graham Fritche is searching for answers. What changed for them from last season to this? I mean, they didn't really lose 20 players, he says. So from becoming one of the positive surprises last year, they're on pace to become the worst team ever in the league. It's a 6 played, 6 lost, 4 scored and 18 conceded. It's, yeah, it's the depths of despair, and it doesn't look to be a way out of the muck for them, does it?
No, not really. It is difficult to kind of figure out exactly what's gone wrong, because, as you say, this team isn't too different. But they have lost kind of key players. Kobayashi at the back, going back to Kobe, I think is a big loss, because they can't rely on their veterans to be there every game. Masako, you know, misses two, plays two, and then just goes again. Yonkopin, I think, has been injured for as long as I can remember. And Hakamata's not very good, as we've mentioned before. And the kind of the players that they did bring in, none of them have really hit the ground running. They brought in like three defensive options and they barely made the squad. The strikers, I think, we'll get onto a question on transfers and underwhelming transfers, but the three of them, Watanabe, Ito and Kleber, I mean, Kleber's offered a bit more than the other two, but really they've not looked like you want an experienced player to come in and kind of control things and score a few goals and look interested, but none of them really do. It's just not worked out for them. And they kind of lost like their squad depth a little bit as well. With they had Koki Saito last year. Sato went to J2, which is ridiculous. Like, pretty much a starting midfielder for them, went to Renofa, which questions have to be asked there. I also lost Ichimi, kind of their main striker. And Nakayama, I think, is a terrific player, gone to Shimizu. So they lost that bit of depth. So when you play these games in quick succession like they have, and they've had to resort to playing Shunsuke Nakamura in central midfield, they've done that twice, and just the problems that causes, and the problems it causes when you have to weaken an already weak defence with rotation. I mean, yeah, they've not dealt with it very well. So they kind of played above themselves last year, but also the manager he put his faith in the youth team, the youth players, a lot more last year, and they kind of took the ball by the horns last season. But this year, he's tried to go back to a few more older players. It's not worked out. And I just don't think that their players actually know where they stand with the manager, because he's making 6-7 changes each game, so there's no real rhythm to it. So, yeah, it's really difficult for them. And I think it's only going to get worse, because once you continually lose games, the manager starts panicking a little bit more, makes a few more changes. He's already changed the goalkeeper this season, which didn't make much sense to me. So, yeah, it's really not working for them. And it's hard to look into that squad and think this is the player, besides Matsuo, that's going to come in and change their fortunes around. It's looking pretty desperate for them.
It's a bit of a head-scratcher, but, yeah, as you say, some key outs in important positions has weakened them overall. And then, yeah, the some of the players, especially the high-profile, in inverted commas, forwards who have come in, struggled to settle, struggled to get going. I think that's a pretty massive understatement. But, we'll wait and see on Yokohama FC. But, again, well done to Tokushima on a first victory of the new season. And well done also to Shimizu S-Pulse for their 2-1 win. That came away at Kashiwa Reysol. Shimizu led 2-0 inside the half hour, through headed goals from Yoshinori Suzuki. That came in just the fourth minute, with the Reysol keeper Kim Sung-gyu making a hash of his attempted save, basically palming the ball into the net down low. There was nothing Kim could do about S-Pulse's second. In the 28th minute, though, Thiago Santana planting a header from a brilliant cross in from the right by Teruki Hara. Yuta Kamiya got Kashiwa back into it with a fine take and a finish in off Shuichi Gonda in the 66th minute. But apart from a couple of scrambles, goalmouth scrambles in the last 10 minutes, Sam Shimizu saw this one out. And, Reysol's early season struggles continue.
Yeah, we all wondered at the start of the season how much Ilunga was going to affect, well, his leaving is going to affect Kashiwa. And I don't think anyone thought it would be quite as bad as this has been, because they are so toothless up front. And in this game, I know there was this COVID outbreak or whatnot, but they were missing, I don't want to speculate that these players definitely had it or whatnot, but when you take out Esaka, Segawa and Goya from this attack, which didn't have much to start with, and you've got Cristiano pretty much on his own, and they're just not creating enough. They don't look like a threat. They're easily contained. Like, this is still Cristiano. He's a good player, but he's 34 now. It's not like, I remember back in, I think, when he was at Kofu, where he was literally the only player in attack for them for like 6 months. It's not like he can do it on his own as he tried to for Kofu at that point. And they're really just not creating too many chances, and they're quite easy to deal with, which is, you don't expect that from a casual team. And defensively, they've not looked too strong either. I mean, what Kim is doing for the first goal is beyond me. He dives under it and then just flicks it into his own net. I mean, horrendous. And the back line in front of them is not really working. Like Kamijima, who had a very good season for Avispa, and I don't know if it's just the start of his season just didn't go, because he got sent off in that first game. Then he played in the Levan Cup in midweek and conceded a penalty. And so he didn't go off to a good start. And he's just been really shaky ever since. I think he was subbed at half-time in this game. So when the team is concerned at the back, both with the goalkeeper and the way the defence are playing, and when they're not getting anywhere near the amount of goals that they need to, it's just a real worry for them. And the opening up of the borders and allowing the foreign players in, it's got to affect Kashiwa more than most, I think, when they've got their strikers coming in. They've got Dodi, this midfielder, coming in, who looks on paper like he'll add a real amount of quality to this team. So they really need those players to step up, because at the moment, I mean, it's looking quite worrying for them. I still don't think that Kashiwa are a relegation candidate, but they've started this season so poorly.
So it's just one of those games, Sam, where the stats just don't tell the story of the game at all. I mean, the shot count is either 9-3 or 12-3, depending where you look, in favour of Reysol, and they've had almost 70% possession. But it sounds like it was almost a Kobe-esque at times, just empty calories, but nothing too threatening that apart from Kami's excellent goal that really troubled Shuichi Gonda or the S-Pulse defence.
Yeah, very little. There was, I think there was one effort where, and it wasn't really actually Kashiwa and Crit. They crossed the ball in and Suzuki headed it in front of Gonda and it went towards their own goal line and Fukumori cleared it off. So that was kind of, besides the goal, was kind of the closest they actually came. Because, yeah, they had a lot of possession, but every team, I think, against a Lotina team is going to have a lot of possession. But they didn't really do anything with it. You didn't think at any time that Shimizu were under the cosh and were about to concede. And there was only that rare bit of quality from Kamiya that Kashiwa really showed. And Shimizu, once they got that 2-0 lead, were very comfortable, I thought. And, yeah, it was worrying for Kashiwa that they didn't create a bit more with the amount of possession that they did have.
All right, then. So before we wrap things up, there was another question. It was quite late from Mike Innes, but yeah, we're very grateful for your contribution to the podcast, Mike. And so Sam, it was wondering about again. It's very early doors, but your thoughts on some of the most and least effective off-season transfers. So obviously some teams have played as many as seven games. Gumba Osaka have only played one, but yeah, most have played five or six so far. And you might have teased part of your answer there in your when you were talking about Yokohama FC, but have there, I don't know, maybe if you want to pick out a couple that have stood out for you so far for positive and maybe a couple for slightly negative reasons as well.
Yeah, I'll start with the positive, and it's two experienced players that you kind of believe that they'd come in and make a difference. Well, no, you didn't. You did with the first one, with Shuichi Gonda, who was coming for Shimizu. I think he's had some really good performances. The one against Tosu springs to mind, where he kind of kept them at bay on his own, and he's just, his goalkeeping has always kind of been pretty spot on, and then he's kind of led that defence as well, and they look very comfortable with him at the back, so he's not put a foot wrong. So I think he's probably one of them, because we're still waiting on a lot of the transfers to come in, and perhaps the ones that are going to have more of an impact are going to be these foreign players. So there aren't too many to choose from, but the other one, the shock of the world, is Yoshito Okubo, who I have to include because he's had the biggest impact, I think, of any of the new signings at 38, coming in, scoring the goals that he has done, starting every game, which is perhaps even more incredible given his age and what he was doing last season. So I think he has to be seen as the most effective new signing. I think he's played well above what everyone thought he would have, and hopefully he gets a bit of a break now that we go to the International/Levain Cup break, and he can kind of put his feet up and go again in April. But yeah, I'd say those two were my most effective signings, and I mean, you can take your pick for ineffective signings. I think I'll clump those Yokohama strikers all together because they've not done anything. Mm. They've don't even combine to make one good signing. I think it's just, you would expect so much more from them. I think they must have looked at it and thought, we need experience to stay in this division. And the combination of Watanabe, Ito and Kleber would do that. And Watanabe, I'd say, would be the worst of those, because just because I had more hope for him. Because whenever he came on for Gamba last season, he scored a few goals. He scored a few important goals. And really, coming on for Yokohama, he's just not really got involved at all. You don't ever believe that Watanabe is going to score for them. So, yeah, he's been particularly disappointing. And I'd also say, and it might come to haunt Nagoya later on in the season, but I think the signing of Kakitani I have to include on this, because they've relied on him to rediscover some old form and be that one player that's going to score goals, and he just doesn't look a threat at all. Like, he's there, but like, what is he doing? He doesn't even contribute too much in the build to it. He's just on the pitch and they play around him. So I think later on in the season, if they don't get a player better than Kakitani, I think having Kakitani will cost Nagoya a potential league title, because he doesn't look like he's ever going to score. I mean, yeah, he's been there, but what's the point of him, to be honest? So, I mean, that's maybe a touch harsh, but yeah, he's not played well. I mean, is there anyone that's caught your eye or not caught your eye that you thought might have done?
Well, yeah, I share your thoughts on the Yokohama FC experiment thing up front. Yeah, I don't know how many strikers they thought they should sign to try and fill the Kazunari Ichimi void, but yeah, it's certainly hasn't worked out for them so far. And well, yeah, I guess you've just got to hold your hand up and say that Okubo is that it's just magic. The lure of a 200 J1 goals, it's brought out the best in him, and for him to be doing it at 38 is absolutely terrific. Obviously Gonda, you know, I'm just going to parrot you all your players, Sam, but yeah, Gonda as an FC Tokyo supporter, as somebody who I had you never wanted him to leave in the first place, but obviously understand why he had to. Of course, Koizumi coming into Reds from Ryukyu, he made quite an impression back on the opening day of the season. So I'm looking forward to seeing more from him as the season progresses. But yeah, thanks to Mike for your question. Always interesting, and all of our contributors have been this week. Sam, we were really spoiled, weren't we? Loads of interesting questions from a wide range of our patrons on a wide range of J1 clubs.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot to delve into, a lot for me to think about on a Monday morning, which is not necessarily when I'm at my best for thinking. But yeah, thank you to everyone for getting involved. Yeah, and it's good to see a lot of clubs actually being mentioned. It's not just focused in on one or two. We've got a whole range of clubs taking people's interest, which is really good to see.
Most definitely. All right. Well, I was going to ask you your final thoughts on the what's going to happen over the international break, Sam. But we're nudging 2 hours, which is remarkable because we've only had Neil on here. But just back to you and me, it seems that we might go on a bit too long, which is puzzling, isn't it? But there you go. So we'll do is again mention that the full national team are playing South Korea in a friendly and then Mongolia in a World Cup qualifier, and the under-24s are playing a pair of friendlies against Argentina under-24s. And we'll be back to discuss whatever has been played by the time we record in next week's episode, perhaps with some extras thrown in at no extra cost. And then we have to wait until Friday, April the 2nd, for the return of J1 when Match Day 7 takes place. There's one game on that Friday night, then 8 on the Saturday, including the return of Gunma Osaka away at Hiroshima, and there's also one game on the Sunday. But we'll obviously cover those games and cross that bridge when we come to it. For now, Sam, we will leave it there. Another bumper episode. Great to get your thoughts as always. And enjoy the international break.
Thank you. I will do. Can't wait for a weekend of Levain Cup. That's always the most exciting weekend of the year. So yeah, we'll get to deal with that. And yeah, look forward to speaking to you again next week.
All right, terrific stuff. So that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk Podcaster. Sam and I would like to thank Neil Debnam for guesting on this week's episode. We'd like to thank our patrons who submitted questions for the episode and all of our supporters on Patreon for their ongoing support. And, of course, listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.